Today on Against the Grain, are the rich wealth creators, as we commonly hear? Should we be grateful to investors and entrepreneurs, as they like to be called, for generating jobs and greasing the wheels of the economy? Or is the source of their massive wealth the rest of us? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Andrew Sayer about rentier, capitalists, and why we can no longer afford the rich. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The world's richest 85 people own as much as the poorest half of the world's population, that is, as much as 3.5 billion people. 46% of the world's wealth is owned by just 1% of the population. In the United States, the top 1% owns 35% of the nation's wealth, while the bottom 40% owns just 0.2%. Yet, as Andrew Sayer asserts, it's not a mystery how the rich have become so rich. My guest today argues that despite their self-description as wealth creators, the rich are in fact wealth extractors. In his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by the University of Chicago Press, Sayer argues that the richer people are, the more their wealth comes from purely unearned sources, from property and finance, not to mention production. His other books include The Moral Significance of Class, and he teaches social theory and political economy at the University of Lancaster. And he joins me now from the UK. Andrew Sayer, let me start by asking you, if you will, to describe the degree of inequality in our respective countries, that is, the US and the UK.
Actually, the US and the UK have some similarities here. And as Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Sayers and people like that have shown over the last century, there's been a dramatic series of changes in the degree of inequality, especially as regards the rich and super rich. And at the one century ago, just after the First World War, the top 1% received about 20% or nearly 20% of total income. That fell in the interwar period, and in the UK fell down to about 6% of total income. But since then, and again in the US it's the same, the rich have bounded back, with the top 1% taking about 12% now of total income, and more of that, more in the US. So the rich have made a huge comeback, and it's largely at the expense of the bottom 99%, but particularly the bottom 90%.
So how do you define the rich? You just used the term, the 1%, something that came out of the Occupy movement, but the top 10%, would we consider them rich as well? How do you define the rich?
Well, as regards the UK, looking at the last 100 years, actually the top 1% versus the 99% has been a key dividing line, because whenever the top 1% have enlarged their share of total income, the 99% have lost out. And that's not just, it could have been different. It could have been the top 5% gaining at the expense of the bottom 95%, or something much more complicated. But throughout the last 100 years, at least in the UK, there's been a kind of hinge point around 99%. So I would say that definitely the top 1% are the rich, but the amount of variation within the top 1% is, of course, far greater than within anywhere else. I mean, they can be people with multi-billions like Bill Gates, or people who are just getting into the top 1% with incomes, well, in the US, just roughly trying to convert from pounds to dollars, they'd be getting a household income of about $250,000, $300,000 a year. There's a matter of degree in it. The richer you are, the more of the problem it is, for various reasons, which we can no doubt talk about.
So you've been giving us a rough sense of how we should think about the rich. Who are they? Whether it's as a percentage of the population, whether it is by income or wealth. But I wonder if you could describe for us, who are the rich? Because, of course, the image that we tend to get in the mainstream media is of celebrities, high-flying movie stars, and so on. Are they the rich, or is the rich a broader group than that?
It's not celebrities in the media, like sports stars and television and film stars. Even someone like Steven Spielberg or Oprah Winfrey, they don't really get anywhere near the top. They're certainly super rich, but most of the super rich, we ordinary people haven't heard of. Okay, there are a few exceptions like Bill Gates, of course, and Donald Trump and so on, and Warren Buffett. But most of them are known only to a few business insiders. So in Britain, most people haven't heard of the top 10, and most of them are foreign, Russian and so on, super rich people who control businesses we haven't heard of in many cases. The richer they are, the more their income tends to be associated with finance and real estate, and the more of it is what I would call unearned income. But no doubt we can talk about what that is later.
Sure. One of the things that we've heard about in this country is very high salaries going to people, say, in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. And that is one group of people who are making a substantial amount. But it sounds like what you're saying is that within the spectrum of the rich, those people will say making $400,000, $500,000 a year, although obviously a lot of money, would be dwarfed by people who are on the top echelons of the 1%, so to speak, whose income and more significantly wealth would be substantially more.
Absolutely. Certainly key medical consultants and other people who have very specialist skills, but also power that goes with that, and can leverage for themselves very high salaries. There's no doubt about that. But they tend to be in the bottom half of the top 1%, if you see what I mean. But to get into the top half, you really need other sources of income, like financial securities and the income which they give you, bonds and shares, and derivatives and so on, and also property, capital gains and such like. Any Get Rich book will tell you that the best way to get rich is not simply by working hard. In fact, maybe you don't need to work hard. It's by getting access to financial assets, which will yield you lots of unearned income.
Right. And we will be talking a lot more about that. In fact, that's sort of the centerpiece of your book, How Are the Rich Rich? But before we get to that, let me ask you, how do the rich spend their money? Because that has a significant role, not just simply as an individual question, how a certain person may spend the money that they have, but it actually has a societal impact.
Yeah. Well, if you're a billionaire, then it's very difficult to spend all your income. At least it is hard to spend it on things which you'll actually get to use in a typical year. For example, you may have four or five houses in different parts of the world, and you're unlikely to be able to stay in any of them for more than short periods. But the more you get, the less you can use them, the less point is in having them. And maybe a couple of private jets would be useful, but any more than that is a complete waste. And likewise, trying to get a bigger yacht than the next billionaire will take several hundred million, perhaps. But if you're a billionaire, that's not making much impression on your wealth. So what they do with most of their wealth is just reinvest it, and seeking new sources of further capital gains. They might invest in property, not in order to live, but just to take advantage of the inflation of its value. So once you get into the multi-millions, it becomes harder and harder to spend on things which you'll actually use. In other words, it's money beyond purpose, in a way.
Andrew Sayer is my guest. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So then the question which you touched on, you mentioned that the rich have not always been as rich as they are now, and that if you look over the 20th century, in the earlier part of the 20th century, the rich were quite rich. That then changed mid-century and then has become concentrated again at the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century. So can you tell us then why the rich are as rich as they are now? What has happened?
In the 1920s, the interwar period, labor grew in strength. The political enfranchisement of labor meant that it had more influence. It was more possible to tax the rich and to reduce their share, their huge share of national income, and also to reduce their wealth. And particularly with the New Deal and the Second World War, that changed economies and changed attitudes as well. So for people to sacrifice themselves for the country in the war, they expected a better life when they returned from the war. And the shift in power towards labor, particularly with the reconstruction after the war, made a huge difference as well. And we experienced in the UK and in the US in the late 1940s to through to the 1960s, very high rates of marginal taxation, which young people today would scarcely believe, over 80% and over 90%, even in the US. So very high earners were very highly taxed. And yet capitalism was very successful in that period from the late 40s through to about early 1970s. That was the most successful period of capitalism, in fact. But capitalism also got into trouble in the sense that globalization meant that industry could run away from well-paid labor in countries like ours to East Asia and so on. That weakened trade unions and labor organization. And also rates of profit in rich countries were also falling in productive industries. And as David Harvey has argued, capital started looking for other outlets, particularly in property and in financial assets. And with the liberalization of finance in the 1970s, that gave them free rein to do so. And so you had a shift away from a kind of productive capitalism after the war, after the Second World War. Starting in the 1970s, late 1970s, towards what I would call a rentier capitalism in which simply controlling assets is the key way to get income, rather than investing considerably in productive industries.
Well, listeners to this program will be familiar with the critique of neoliberalism, which you've been talking about over the last 40 years and the characteristics of it, from change in regulation, financialization, a kind of project of what perhaps could be called a class war from above. But one of the things that you stress, Andrew Sayer, in your book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, which certainly is less stressed in other analyses of neoliberalism, including radical ones, is that a key component actually had to do with the composition of the 1% wealthiest people, and that the wealth became even more concentrated at the top of the 1%. Why is that significant to you in your analysis?
Well, yes. I mean, I agree with lots of other people on the basic features of neoliberalism: marketization, privatization, liberalization of financial markets. The market is the default or optimal form of organization. And also with the kind of cultural changes, which your local author, Wendy Brown, has written about. Sure. of how we all are expected to become little entrepreneurs of our own lives, looking after our human capital and so on. But I think there's a third thing, which is not simply a shift from labor to capital, but to a different kind of capital, in particular the rise of finance and the way in which getting wealth by controlling assets, as I mentioned earlier, that other people need or which yield streams of unearned income, is seen as the key way to enrich oneself. And that's come to the fore hugely in the last 30 or 40 years, with finance taking up so much more of economies than they used to do. And whereas previously they were primarily a support for productive industry, providing credit, oiling the wheels of industry and so on, and investment, now it's largely a self-serving, extractive sector. It extracts wealth more than it contributes towards the production of wealth.
Well, we will talk more as the hour goes on about capitalists who make their money from finance and who don't. But I want to just zero in on the key argument at the center of your book, which is an argument about how wealth is created. There is a whole set of beliefs, which are very commonly held, that those, certainly in the United States, that those people who are rich because they have earned their money. They are people like Steve Jobs, who have created enormous amounts of money through the brilliance of their own vision, and that the money that they make, therefore, is rightfully earned. You make quite a different argument in the book, which is that we need to think again, in a way that hasn't been done perhaps in centuries, about wealth as the product of extraction. So I wonder if you could contrast those two arguments, one about capitalists as wealth creators, or as the term they like, entrepreneurs, and then capitalists and the wealthy as those extracting wealth.
Well, first of all, what is wealth? It's not simply money. Money is a claim on wealth. Wealth is useful goods and services, at least economic wealth is. And some of them are sold, some of them are not sold. So when you have public schools, free state schools, then wealth is being produced. Useful services are produced by teachers, and they're consumed, as it were, or used. They benefit other people. And that is wealth. That is part of wealth. Ordinary people producing or contributing directly or indirectly to the production of useful goods and services are creating wealth. And what money does is give you a claim on wealth that is produced by other people. And most people get their money from wages and salaries for contributing to the production of goods and salaries. And so they're getting something back. Whether it's as much as they contribute is another matter, but they do get, their pay is conditional upon contributing in directly or indirectly to the production of goods and services. But you can also get money without contributing anything new. If you can get control of some property, say you buy some, you already have a house, but you have some spare cash, you buy up a lot of cheap housing, and you start renting it out to people who can't afford housing, then you're not actually providing anything that didn't already exist. You haven't created anything new. You are using your power in controlling those resources to get unearned income. And there are situations where you can get both earned income, that is income conditional upon producing goods and services, and unearned income, but you can get a bit of both. And chief executive officers may, to some extent, contribute to the provision of goods and services. And they may be quite important for that. And maybe Steve Jobs was, although he didn't do anything on his own. But also simply by virtue of their power, by virtue of the existence of hierarchies and they being the people who happen to be at the top of them, and they may be very good at being at the top of them, they can use that to lever extra income for themselves, which is effectively unearned. It's not in exchange for anything. So someone who controls a firm by virtue of being owner or being a manager is getting paid not only for what they contribute, but simply on the basis of having power, because it's hard to stop them. And as long as in public companies, as long as managers provide shareholders with rising value, share values and good dividends, then they're going to be allowed probably to rake off quite a lot for themselves.
So,
and Steve Jobs and people like that, yes, in some ways, you may say they're quite admirable. And my criticism is, of them is much less of than it is of people who overwhelmingly get their money and without contributing to production of new goods and services. So by contrast, there's a Mexican super billionaire who's sometimes been at the top of the world wealth list, Carlos Slim Helú, who took over the Mexican telecommunications system. And that gave him instant access to what was effectively rent coming from the millions of people who had to use that service. He wasn't actually providing anything new. So that's rather different. But you can get money simply by virtue of power stemming from control of assets. And a big company is an asset. But I would also add, it's always important to remember, and I think some people like Jobs will occasionally recognize this, that they were also the beneficiaries of living in a society with a very highly developed science and infrastructure and education system and so on. And they also couldn't do anything on their own. There were lots of unknown people working for them who made important contributions as well, but who are not in such positions of power to take as much income as he could.
Well, and staying with him, because one of the points that you make in your book is that we should be critical of the rich, not because we want to revile them as individuals, but because structurally there's something very wrong about having this class of people who are able to have the power and wealth that they do. So staying with someone who might be more appealing, like a Steve Jobs, the presumption is if he is getting a much larger slice of earnings than whatever he would have contributed himself, then the presumption is that there are other people who aren't getting that. Is that right? That that if wealth is being transferred to the rich, it's got to come from somewhere. Where does it come from?
Yeah, well, as the neoliberal thinker Milton Friedman said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And if you do get a free lunch, that is at someone else's expense. So if you're basically living, for example, off rent or capital gains on property, then you're getting free lunches. You're getting something for nothing. And I think we should use that term, that phrase, something for nothing, against the rich rather than against, as it's usually used, against people on welfare. So just as a child can only get a free meal if its parents provide it one with one and do the work of buying it and preparing it and so on, so someone who gets a free meal through inheritance or capital gains or something like that can only get that windfall, that free lunch, if there are other people producing wealth. Because say you get $100,000 of capital gains on some property and you can actually realize that, then you want to spend that. That money only has value if there are goods and services that other people can have produced, which you can buy. And they must be obviously goods and services which they themselves can't afford to produce. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any left over for you. So do you see what I mean? That unearned income can only exist if others are producing more than they're getting back in their pay.
So in other words, the majority of people are producing a surplus that then gets transferred upwards.
Yeah.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll take a music break and be back in a moment with Andrew Sayer. Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Andrew Sayer. He is the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by University of Chicago Press. So one of the key distinctions, and you've touched on it already, is the distinction between earned and unearned income. And I wonder if you could tell us why this term fell out of circulation. It's not a term that we hear in the mainstream media, in discussions about the economy, economic crisis, or in even inequality. So when was this distinction more significant, and what happened to it?
Well, it began to be used, I think, in the late 18th century. And right through, it's very common in any writing about politics and economy into the early 20th century. And the so-called ethical socialists like R.H. Tawney and J.A. Hobson would often refer to this. And it continued after the Second World War as well. And in fact, I don't know about in the US, but in the UK, on our tax returns, when we fill them in, we have to distinguish between unearned and earned income. And unearned income embraces capital gains, inheritances, rent. And by rent, I don't mean, paying rent to your landlord to cover maintenance costs. That's perfectly reasonable that you pay for maintenance or pay for the towards the original construction costs. It's also interest. Money's rent. Banks create new money to lend out, and the cost of doing so is negligible, but they can charge interest to you on it. And also profit on production, simply by virtue of controlling production, the owner or their delegates can the man delegate managers can skim off profit for themselves, which is a form of unearned income just based upon ownership. So with people like Jobs, just to go back to him, Steve Jobs, I mean, you have to ask, well, if they weren't owners or part owners, how much would they get? And one can imagine that normally they get considerably less. But yeah, that distinction is extremely important. Why did it fall out of use? Well, it's hard to explain an absence, of course, but one has to be suspicious with the rise of neoliberalism, increasingly dependent on unearned income, and trying to, with the idea of popular capitalism, to make it generally part of life. And to some extent in the US, at least with stocks, I understand that quite a lot of ordinary American citizens play the stock market. Well, they are small-time rentiers. They are living off a certain amount of rentier income, although probably not making a huge amount out of it. They're not the big-time ones. But it wasn't in order to appeal to people. The term unearned income was perhaps seen as unappealing, and people like to believe that what they get is what they deserve. And so you can imagine, well, this is very common in Britain. So in a place like London, which has a ridiculous housing market where the house prices are going up 10% or 13% per year, and people get capital gains, and they tend to think, well, they deserve it, so that they've been prudent, or that maybe they're underpaid at work anyway, so it's okay. They're loath to believe that this is something for nothing and at someone else's expense. In effect, it's siphoning off or free riding on other people's work. They're loath to believe that, but then nobody's telling them that. That's why I wanted to write this book, to tell them that actually they are the free riders. So I don't know about any kind of conspiracy, but it is interesting to say the least that over the last 30, 40 years, just at the very time unearned income has started to grow again, the term falls out of use, or well, the distinction between earned and unearned income falls out of use.
Well, and it's interesting that language does seem to be an issue in perhaps obfuscating some of the distinctions about how the economy actually operates, that there are a number of words which have dual meanings, and that within sort of popular use of language basically gives wealth and power often a pass. You mentioned the term investment and wealth. Why should we be a little careful about how we use these words?
Yes, well, I think the easiest one is there's three. There's earnings, investment, and then wealth. And earnings is the simplest one. And I think some people notice this when a hedge fund manager or something like that says they've earned so many tens of millions or something like that, or some cases billions. A lot of people will say, oh, yes, earned, or just got, just procured, if you like. And we have two meanings to the word earned in English and in many other languages, apparently, where on the one hand, it means what you get from the market. On the other hand, it means what you deserve. If I say I earned that $1,000, I really earned it, that implies that I, you know, I say it with emphasis, I'm implying that I deserve it. I didn't just get it by virtue of my position. But it is it's an important distinction. And okay, it's always going to be fuzzy. How much should we get is always going to be a contestable thing. But in many cases, it's perfectly clear that just by controlling a resource or by being the child of a super rich person, getting an inheritance, you're getting something for nothing. I think actually the most important of all is the word investment, because it's one of these words which always sounds good. And if you're an investor, it sounds like you're some kind of benefactor, social benefactor, and a very clever, prudent person as well, and some kind of happy conjunction between private self-interest and the public good. But it's actually used in two very different senses. And one you could call the wealth creation sense, where you actually invest, well, in the 18th century, it might have been canals, and 19th century railways and so on, and textiles. And now we invest in things which actually produce benefits, like improving broadband systems or something like that. So, or teaching people, training people so they get new skills. That actually creates objective benefits. And then there's the second sense, which is to do with wealth extraction, where it's all looked at from the point of view of the person providing the funding. Whatever brings you a return, a positive return, is an investment, or certainly a good investment. And it doesn't matter whether it produces any objective benefits, any wealth creation or not. You're not concerned with that. If you're a so-called investor on the financial markets, then you don't care whether a billion pounds comes from mere wealth extraction, unearned income, or whether it comes from actually contributing to objective improvements in infrastructure and training and the way we live our lives. And that elision, if you like, between those two meanings is extremely important, because it allows people to pass off wealth extraction, which is merely provides them, say, with some interest on some savings or something like that, as an actual contribution, in a form of wealth creation, in fact, in the economy. And that's often not the case. The two can go together, of course. And I think if you do risk some funds in a productive investment, then I can't see anything wrong with getting some share of the benefits of that. But if you're merely using your money, for example, to lend out for someone to buy some existing property, well, you're not actually creating anything new. You're just taking advantage of your strength relative to their weakness and making them pay you for it, give you some unearned income. So that's the second one. Wealth, the third one, I think I effectively explained that earlier, that real economic wealth is actual use values, as political economists call it, goods and services which actually benefit people, whether it's teaching or whether it's cooking or looking after elderly people or producing food or software and so on. And then wealth in the financial sense is a financial or monetary claim upon those goods and services, that you can get people to sell you them. And that's quite different.
So in terms of the mechanisms through which wealth is extracted in our societies, you mentioned rents. Then you also write about interest. And there historically has been a long critique of interest, quite a lot of it actually coming out of religion, right, about usury. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about why interest is a problem for society in general.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the amount of interest, the rate of interest makes a difference. If it's only 1% and it's that is real interest rate, as that's taken into account inflation, then that's less of a problem than a 10% interest rate or a 20 or a 1,000%, which sometimes with payday lenders you get. So it depends upon the amount, how serious it is. But Let me give you a striking homely analogy, if you like. If you're hard up and you can't pay your bills, and you ask a comfortably off friend, can you lend me $1,000 so I can pay my bills? And this friend said, well, yeah, okay, but I'm going to charge you 5% interest, and if you don't pay me back in a given time, I'm going to seize some of your assets equivalent to the value of the loan plus interest. Well, it would be pretty clear to you that that was the end of the friendship, wouldn't it? That this person, this so-called friend, was taking advantage of your weakness. And both the religious and secular critiques of usury boil down basically to that argument that the terrible thing about usury is that it allows the strong to take advantage of the weak. And obviously, as I said, it's a matter of degree. If it's 1% interest, it's not very much. It doesn't really matter much. But if it's many, many, much higher than that, and if it actually impoverishes the debtor and allows the creditor to demand work for them and to dominate them. And we do see modern examples of this. And I actually think the Greek episode recently was an example of the creditors dominating the debtors in a shocking, quite shocking way, which fits totally with the critique of usury. It exemplifies exactly what the critique of usury was getting at. So there's that kind of moral economic argument, which I think is still really important. But also, interest is dysfunctional, as Keynes argued, and he's hardly a radical. It's a kind of deadweight cost, payment for nothing. And also, what a lot of people don't realize is that private banks create money that they lend out, and they're not actually lending other people's money out who've left deposits in their banks. They're creating money, which is virtually costless. They just type in some money into people's accounts, and then they get paid back, but they get paid back with interest.
Can you explain how that works? Because I think a lot of listeners would say, but wait a minute, so banks are creating essentially fictional money that they're lending out. How is that possible?
Well, because they're allowed to do so. And 97% of all money now is digital money. And only about 3% is cash, coins, and bills, and so on. And they do it just by typing. When you take out a mortgage, a loan for a property or something like that, or a car loan, auto loan, what they do is type so many $1,000s into your account, and you pay that back, but you pay it back with interest. And maybe you're paying back interest over 20, 30 years. And that's quite considerable. And that provides the bank with unearned income, basically. And there are also big questions about lending money against property, which just very often just tends to inflate its value, especially with housing, most particularly. And that has dysfunctional effects as well on economies, that increasing amounts of wealth are just tied up in property instead of being used for productive purposes to produce new things, including new houses. So the banks create money. I think initially central banks were reluctant to acknowledge this, but the Bank of England now acknowledges, and American banks have now acknowledged it. They create money. And I think that's finally out into the public domain at last. And that's a very important power. It's important to be able to create money. If everybody stashes their spare savings under their mattress, then the amount of money in the economy shrinks and the economy suffers. It's important to create money, but how you create it and what you create it for is very important. So in Britain now, with the election to the Labour Party leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, there's a big debate about quantitative easing, which is money creation. And it's been done to benefit the financial sector previously, creating money to help bail out the financial sector. And there's been very little criticism of it. It's just been seen as technically necessary. But Jeremy Corbyn, as and many on the left, are arguing that it should be used carefully for supporting important infrastructure investments, which actually provide long-term benefits, especially as regards renewable energy. Creating money is very important in societies, and it's important to have democratic control of it, rather than just leave it on the basis of extremely powerful banks being able to do it wherever it happens to benefit them and increase their power.
Andrew Sayer is my guest. He's professor of social theory and political economy at Lancaster University. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and we're discussing his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich. That's published by University of Chicago Press. So you've been describing in this hour how the rich, and especially the very rich, draw their wealth from primarily unearned income that takes various different forms. Rents is one, interest is another, production is another one. And there's so much to discuss here, but I wonder if we can turn, because the hour is running down, to talk about something which I think is a key dimension of what you're arguing and why you think this is such an urgent question, which is the environmental impact of the rich. What kind of ecological footprint do the rich leave?
Well, as you get wealthier, you spend more, and not surprisingly, your carbon footprint tends to get bigger. So the richer individuals are, the bigger their carbon footprint. And at a worldwide level, the top 7% of earners, which includes a lot of just well-off, reasonably well-off people in the rich countries, the top 7% of population worldwide are responsible for 50% of emissions, which is also interesting in that we're about 50% over, or rather we're double what the Earth can actually absorb in terms of greenhouse gases. So we're producing twice as much in greenhouse gases as the Earth can absorb, but half of what we're producing is produced by that richest 7%. So here it goes beyond the what I previously, earlier in the book, are targeting as the rich and super rich. But the rich are involved not only through their consumption, but through their dependence on unsustainable growth, and in many cases, quite specifically, in their dependence on investments in fossil fuel extraction. So in order, for example, to get repaid your loans and get interest on all the loans that you've made to people into the future, then that really depends upon future growth. The economy's got to grow in order to make that affordable. So that makes it all the more unsustainable, because it's in a very simple point, which I think the Pope made, which is that quite simply, exponential growth in a finite world is an absurdity, and we have to face up to that fact. The idea of green growth, where we can continue to grow but without growing our carbon footprints and so on, is a pipe dream at the moment. Yes, we are managing to produce things with less carbon, but population growth plus increasing consumption is far outstripping the reduction in carbon in intensity of the stuff that we consume. So this means that certainly the rich and the super rich have to consume less, but we've got to stop that investment in fossil fuels. And we also need a kind of economy which is not dependent on growth, which doesn't crash immediately. Growth slows up, as it is, as it has done in the last 5 years.
Well, I'd like to ask you more about how you think we could get to that, but let me ask you this question. So you're arguing that we need to be turning toward a kind of steady state economy, that the exponential growth that is characteristic of the societies we live in is not sustainable. One question, though, that comes to my mind is, you were talking earlier about the rich using their wealth in unproductive ways, through rents, for example. But would it be better if they were using them in productive ways, given that that would increase growth?
It's a kind of paradox, isn't it? That on the one hand, I'm saying that they're too rich and they're not spending their money on productive uses. But if they were to spend it more on productive uses, might not that just speed up?
Right.
Yes, it might. It depends how it's spent. And so we really have to have a kind of wartime mobilization of investment in green technology, coupled especially in the short run with a reduction in consumption levels by the rich and super, by the rich and the well off, so that we don't expect to be able to make several long haul flights per year. We don't expect to have second and third homes and jet skis and other wasteful things like that. That we do actually need to do things like eat less meat, because it's extremely inefficient way of producing calories, and also very bad for greenhouse emissions and so on. So this is the world is indeed at a crisis point. And I'm not talking about the economic crisis here. I'm talking about the climate crisis, because if we tip over beyond 2 degrees Celsius increase, it's almost certain that we'll have runaway global warming, which is impossible to stop. And that is a terrible future for our children and future generations. So it does require very, well, back to basics thinking and drastic measures, and all this to be done very quickly, which is, I know, asking a lot, but things are really serious, and I don't think most people are taking climate change nearly seriously enough. They think that, well, that's a minor problem that can be dealt with on the way, just by getting a little bit better insulation in your house or something like that, or having low energy and light bulbs. That's not going to do it. We need drastic action quickly.
Well, let's talk about, since you're saying these things are all tied together, really, the political implications of thinking about how to reduce the power of the rich. You write that certain concrete steps would go a ways toward reining that power in. What would those steps look like?
Well, with rent, I would have kind of land value taxes, which have been advocated not only by the left, but actually by some figures on the right, like Henry George, of course, and even Milton Friedman said a land value tax is the least bad tax. So you tax away those free lunches, if you like, and return them to the public who effectively paid for them. And interest, where interest is concerned, that's tied to credit. I think credit needs to be brought under democratic control to not totally, but to a significant extent, so that it's used for funding necessary productive investment, particularly in the foreseeable future, with an huge emphasis upon sustainable energy, sustainable ways of living. And as regards other forms of unearned income, I think ensuring that employees and users of products and services should be the key stakeholders, not absentee shareholders. I mean, it is absurd that shareholders are the almost the only stakeholder. You know, I can buy some shares in Monsanto or whatever. The money that I pay doesn't go to Monsanto. It goes to the previous owner of those shares. I'm not invested in the company at all. But I then get a bit of power over what happens to Monsanto if I buy a lot. And I get this unearned income in the form of capital gains by trading shares and dividends and so on. I should not be a stakeholder. It should be the employees and key users or representatives of users. And it's a question of justice, but it's also functional for the economy, that way you're more likely to get an economy which is serving the public rather than providing a kind of disservice. And I think it's very important that with that, people like Gaurav Porovitz have argued, we need much more cooperatively organized economic organizations. So there the workers clearly are the prime stakeholders. And one of the attractive things about them in a no-growth future is that they can survive without constantly expanding. They can stay at one level. And that would actually probably also mean that there would be less competition, and I think we need less mobility of capital. Competition can be a good thing. It can raise standards and should be retained in many sectors, but there can be competition between competing cooperatives. And internationally, competition, again, is a very mixed bag in terms of its benefits. So we do really need to rethink economies rather than just assuming that business as usual is the only possibility.
Well, I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Andrew Sayer, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Andrew Sayer. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by the University of Chicago Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches social theory and political economy at Lancaster University in the UK. I'm Sasha Lilly. You've been listening to Against the Grain. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.